please follow Doublette 76 on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn.
You cannot be serious! You cannot be serious! You cannot be serious!
Hello, my name is Tom Heinke. I'm recording the first time in English language tennis podcast Doublette 76. I was born 1976. My dear co-host and friend from England, the co-founder of Life Jacket and the global champion in straight arm drinking, Jono Sumner. Welcome.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, bud?
And thank you for standing right next to me playing doubles against or together with my first guest, Conor Nyland from Ireland. Welcome, Conor.
Two-on-ones will do. Two-on-ones. Thank
you. Two-on-ones.
What is straight arm drinking? That's what I want to know straight off the bat.
Jono can explain to you.
I was trying to understand what value I'm bringing to this. I'm not sure that's quite the start I was after. But yeah, I think it's a game Tom and I have played a couple of times over the years. But,
yeah.
All very daft.
Excellent.
Well, and Jono's very good at it. Conor, you wrote a very interesting book. I listened to it between 6 to 7 hours. The book is called The Racket, and I have to drop so many names just to introduce you and to give the listeners a feeling how much people you met. You played tennis at Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy. You were the hitting partner of Serena Williams. You practiced with Sharapova, Peter Korda. You played college tennis in Berkeley. You met the NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers, Manorino in Wimbledon. You played on Arthur Ashe against Novak Djokovic. And, well, you practiced with Richard Gasquet, which I really like this episode of your book. You played against the German Julian Reister. Kind regards from him. He really loved to play against you. This is what he mentioned. Maybe we'll talk about it later. And, well, now, you bet Federer and the juniors. Man, I don't know, honestly, where to start. And you bet and bageled Jim May, the legend, from Great Britain. Kind regards from Jim as well, which was a former teammate of Jono. You bageled him. Yeah,
we had a few battles as well.
So, welcome. Honestly, I try to introduce you to the listeners. You're born 1981 in Birmingham, right, in England. But you have to move quite fast to Ireland. So you feel 110% Irish?
Yeah, I do. I was born in England. My parents are Irish. They moved to England for about 10 years, actually. My dad is a doctor and got a job there. So my older sister got really into tennis, lived across the road from a really nice tennis club, Edgbaston Priory, which has a WTA event. So we got really into tennis there. And then when I was 3, we moved back to Ireland. So I don't have any memories of, England. Now, I did go back there for boarding school when I was 16. But definitely a connection with England, and my brother's been there for the last 25 years as well, and he lives in Wimbledon. But so a connection with England, but yeah, I feel and always felt Irish. That was definitely something that comes up in the book, because obviously there's more opportunity, I guess, as a British playing with the British flag for wildcards and funding and all that. But I guess I played Davis Cup at 18 for Ireland, and that was me sort of set as an Irish player. From
maybe that would be a perfect start, Jono. What do you think that we talk about the upcoming Davis Cup match against Tunisia in 1 week, 13th of September? You have to play on clay. What I learned from you, Jono, as well, that you, and from your audiobook, that you don't have too many clay courts in Ireland, for sure, right?
Yeah, we don't. We don't have enough. Our main club, Fitzwilliam, now has four clay courts, which is great. But obviously, we get quite a bit of rain, and it just isn't as conducive to clay courts. But our number one player, Michael Agui, was born in Ireland, but has been raised in Germany and is based in Berlin. His favorite and most natural and native surface is clay, is red clay. So that's great. So he's able to, you know, to come in and play with no problem. And then we have Conor Gannon, who played the last tie in El Salvador on clay, our last away tie this time last year, and played great singles and doubles, beat Aravalo on clay, who's, you know, was I think about 14 in the world in doubles at the time, and I think his best surface is actually clay. So pretty adaptable. It's not obviously our natural native surface, but I think the guys are pretty experienced getting out and playing junior events and futures on clay at this stage, so it's not like it's a whole new world and these guys are, you know, serving and volleying and then having to adapt. It's not quite as drastic as that. So yeah, we've won away matches on clay in the recent couple of years, so we're pretty comfortable.
Cross fingers. Well, yeah. You are sitting on the bench. What makes more fun, play yourself or sitting on the bench and seeing Dugas, Echargu, Mansouri, Uokwa playing against Ireland again next week?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know if Davis Cup was always very exciting and obviously really fun, but the actual matches were always a little bit stressful, and it's the same as a coach as it was as a player. You know, it's a different type of a feeling when you're playing for your country. And yeah, I try and be very calm as a coach. Like my first couple of ties as a captain, I was quite animated, and you know, a lot of energy, and it's like listening when you're listening to the US Open. It's been interesting. You can hear the microphone now with the players box, and you can hear like James Trotman coaching and speaking to Jack Draper a lot, and it's very high energy, which is really interesting to hear. Everyone's got their own style, and I'm a little bit more calm, because I think Davis Cup, as I say, it's quite emotional and quite draining for the players. So I try and be a little bit of a safe space for them when they come back at the change of ends, and I don't try and give them loads of information. Just try and pick out one or two small things and try and keep them kind of relaxed.
Jono,
how do you feel, Connor, with growing up playing tennis? And obviously I'm terrible, nothing to shout about. Funnily enough, I actually played at Edgestone Priory for a year when I was up at university in Birmingham
for a year,
so I played there for a bit, so really nice setup. I don't know, I'm quite anti, I'm not talking about Davis Cup, I'm talking about during tournaments, I'm quite anti coaching on court. I've always quite enjoyed tennis for it being you have to work it out yourself on court in isolation, so I've always been in that camp. I don't know if you have a particular preference.
So was I, Jono. I was exactly the same. I thought tennis, that's our point of difference. You know, you're out there on your own. You have to figure it out by yourself. And it was going to be this, I suppose, this slightly chaotic, you know, are there going to be mums and dads shouting down at their players now, saying they're coaching them? And I think the fact that they've done it the way they've done it, you know, only when you're on one side, and then they've mic'd up the coaching box. It's been really interesting, especially the US Open is kind of the most noticeable. I don't know if it's the way they've done it with the mics, but it just feels really clear, and with the Sky Sports, the way the coverage, the way they're doing it, you're hearing the coach's input, and I'm starting to see the players react to that, and I think it was David Witt saying to Francis Tiafoe a couple of nights ago, you know, body serve, and then he goes and you see, well, will he listen? Will he hit the body serve? And he hits the body serve. The guy misses the return, and all of a sudden, this match as a spectator is slightly more interesting because now there's this sort of subplot of is he listening to his coach or not? And I think again, going back to Trotman and Draper, I think, it's been really interesting to see that dynamic. And also, what struck me about Draper is he doesn't look to the box all that much. He's not looking for things. It seems like it's quite a nice relationship. It seems quite sort of trusting, and James seems to be leading it, and Jack seems to be taking on the information. So, yeah, I found it kind of refreshing, but I was in exactly the same camp as you. I didn't want them to mess with that, I suppose, slightly sacred sort of, you know, element of tennis where you're out there on your own, and I didn't want that to change, but I actually think it's working out okay.
Fair enough.
Guys, board prediction, please. US Open. We are recording one day before the semifinals because you've mentioned Jack Draper. I think he hasn't lost a set. Is that correct? Yet?
Yeah, he hasn't lost a set. Yeah. No.
Who's going to make it? What do you say, Jono, Connor?
I think Draper obviously hasn't lost a set. He's been very impressive, but at the same time, he will admit before any of us that, you know, the draw has been pretty kind to him. I think he was coming into it in a good place, and he's definitely like a top 10, starting to look like a really legitimate top 10 guy right now, never mind in a year or two. Obviously Alcaraz losing opened it up for him. I think Sinner is, you know, a bigger talent, a better player right now. So I think it's going to be tough for him. But obviously, Sinner has been dealing with the whole doping thing and actually has navigated the whole tournament surprisingly well. But maybe he's got a bad match in him, you know, because of all what's been going on for the last 6 months. So, like, I definitely think Draper has a real chance, and if he can get off to a good start and hit his spots on the serve, he could sneak a tiebreak and maybe get ahead of him. But I'm still leaning towards Sinner. A Sinner Fritz final and Sinner to win it is probably where I see it over the next couple of days. I don't know what you think, Jono.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, part of me would love to see Draper do it, but on paper alone, you'd lean towards Sinner. I didn't quite see it in that. So, I'm afraid. I'd probably have to join with you in saying, yeah, it's funny the parallels, isn't it, with Draper, and you look at Raducanu when she won the US, she didn't drop a set all the way through. So you've got that kind of that interesting parallel going. Sinner's got that experience, got that big game to him, so I think he'll. I imagine he'll manage it. It is genuinely nice to see. I'm not sure of the stats, but to see an American, you know, obviously compared to years ago, and Tom probably in your heyday of watching and loving, and yours as well, Connor, and playing, you know, obviously Americans packed throughout the top 10, 20, 30, 40. It's nice to see a couple of those guys, you know, like Tiafoe, like Fritz, that were going to have a finalist that's American at Flushing Meadows. That's cool. And you've got, you know, other boys and guys in there involved as well. Obviously, American ladies sort of better track records. So I think it'd be cool to have an American in the final. I'd like to see Fritz make the final. I'd like to see Draper, but I think Sinner, and I think Sinner's got it overall.
Yeah. Jono, yeah, the good thing is... Go on, Connor. No, please.
I think it's really important actually for tennis, certainly in the US, but I think globally, to have American success. You know, I think it makes the tournament bigger, of course, and I just think from a cultural relevance perspective, you know, I think Americans kind of, you know, the casual American sports fan only gets interested in tennis when there's Americans sort of dominating and at the very top. I think that's really, really important. And as you say, they've got a kind of a crop of, they've been beating each other. Like Shelton and Tiafoe could have gone either way, and it could easily be Shelton in the semifinals. And Tommy Paul on the other side. And then, as you say, obviously Jessica Pegula coming through too. Coco Gauff winning it last year. So it seems like there's a bit of a movement happening for American tennis. I just think that's really positive for tennis globally when the Americans are, you know, are up there. So it's good to see.
Tommy and Connor, I have a question for you two.
Please. Okay?
Yeah, but this is very,
of course,
very quick. So, Connor, I don't know, but Tom mentioned that me and a couple of friends, we set up a company called Life Jacket, and we do all things skin protection in there. Now, obviously, there's been a bit of furore around Yannick Sinner recently. With, I think it was Clostebol was the steroid that he was tested positive for. He is he's certainly the face for La Roche-Posay, who are, I mean, saying he's a competitor of ours is probably overstating us. We're a total minnow. I was thinking of dropping a message to Jack Draper, asking if he would like to be a Life Jacket ambassador, and then just say, but the added benefit is our products don't contain steroids.
Best of luck, Jono. I wish you all the best in the campaign.
I don't know, yeah. I wondered if that was... But it stands out. It's something different, right? Anyway.
You better get on to him quick. Yeah. He's on court in about 3 hours.
Yeah. I thought that might be an angle. Might get a rise out of him.
Yeah. Well, Connor, before we talk about your match on Arthur Ashe at US Open against Novak Djokovic, add something that Jono just mentioned, because I listened to your audiobook, which was really big fun. You read it by yourself. I think it took 6 or 7 hours, and you mentioned and you talked about doping in your audiobook and the written version for sure as well. And I got the 100% same opinion like you. Maybe you let the listeners know what's your personal opinion about doping and tennis, because I think you mentioned there are cheaters everywhere, right?
Well, what I said was, obviously, the balance of probability, you know, is that there's players out there that are doing it, and obviously certain players have been caught doping. Some have been quite obvious. Some were traveling with, you know, growth hormone and tested. But then you have the sort of Yannick Sinner cases where I don't think he was doping personally. I think it was, it was a case that these guys are tested. I think it's probably once a month, maybe. And occasionally you've got a player that has some trace of something that's banned in a substance that they come into contact with. And I think Yannick Sinner's story, for me anyway, kind of checks out. I think it's okay. But yeah. We obviously have doping cases like you do in every sport. My point in the book was that, and if you read the book, you'll understand that the life of a tennis player, you know, outside the top 100 at least, is so sort of chaotic, and you don't know whether you're going to be playing a futures next week, a challenger next week, if you're going to lose second round or win the tournament. You know, trying to have a doping program going on in the background with all sorts of, doctors that you'd have to pay. You know, we could barely pay for flights and hotels. So, doping programs were sort of the least of the priorities. Trying to just get through the next day and the next match was sort of, I think, where most 99.9% of tennis players were focused on. But yeah, we obviously have... You know, Sinner, we have Irani, we have Sharapova, Cilic. There's been a few big names, and Grand Slam champions, obviously, that have come to the fore the last few years. So I think it's more the casual sports fan, I'll use that phrase again, when they hear those suspicions and those incidents happening, they don't go in, they don't look into the details like we do. Like, they won't go and read the Sinner case, the tribunal report, but we will, and we'll see, okay, I can kind of see how he got tested positive, but the guy who's, you know, down the pub watching the football, who hears about Sinner, probably thinks, oh, all those tennis players are taking something, and that's sort of the problem, the reputation aspect. And I think what I didn't like about the Sinner case was that it was announced sort of together at the end, once it was all sorted out, as opposed to, you know, it coming out immediately that he had failed a test. And then I think there maybe should have been some sort of a short suspension process for a couple of months while they figured it all out. And I think that for me was the thing I didn't like about the whole Sinner case.
Yeah. I think he had...
Connor, that, do you think that... I guess the flip side would be... obviously, consistency is one thing, right? So the guy that's not ranked number 1, 2, 3 in the world should be treated the same procedurally as the guy ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 500. So that's a, I guess, a separate conversation. I guess in that sense of, as you said, the moments you know, I was watching a program at Linford Christie the other day, so athletes in track and field is quite, you know, it's been quite a story and quite prevalent. There's a part of me that thinks almost if someone is found innocent or cleared, should that even be released conceptually, right? Because that person is forever going to face that, be tainted or face that challenge, right, of that process. And I ask that not with an opinion, I ask that in an open sense. But I guess it's that thing of, you know, if it's a mistake or if something's happened, we know the reality of that person's name gets sullied as a result. Yeah. So there's an element of, does anonymity, is there a time and a place for anonymity in it?
And he and the sinner actually lost his points and prize money from Indian Wells, right? Which I thought was a strange sidebar to the whole thing. You know, right, either we're completely happy with this, or we're not. I don't get why prize money and points should be lost because of it. So yeah, no, I think that's a good point. But then I guess they need to be seen to at least be walking us through the process. And I guess in a court, not that I'm a solicitor but, or anything, but you know, in a court, you know, you get proven innocent at the end of a public trial for the most part. So maybe it's a sense of that. But again, the fact that they came through as a bit of a partnership, announcing together, like finding out about it on Yannick Sinner's Instagram account, isn't how I think I should be finding out about, you know, a failed test 6 months later. And also, I mean, if Sinner playing through that, I guess, suspended sentence, whatever we want to call it, when he was allowed play through the summer, let's say he had gone and won Wimbledon, you know, he's obviously stopped a finalist and a semi-finalist from their biggest victories of their career. If he then post that does get test, you know, test positive and it's upheld that he broke the doping violation, then he stopped people as well. So there's a couple of issues. And I also think there should probably be a threshold amount that he was less than a billionth of a gram in his system. I think that is, you know, such a negligible amount that maybe there should be a threshold allowed that, you know, it's such a trace amount, it shouldn't show up as a failed test. But
yeah. Well, we are curious how this case will be treated in the future and how, well, people will talk about it. If we talk about poison, Connor, I kindly ask you to talk about food poisoning. I think you know what's coming up. We just give some teasers to the listeners from your book. And, I mean, you played on Arthur Ashe against Novak Djokovic. And what happened the day before, mate? What was going on court? I was almost crying when I listened to this episode of your audiobook.
Yeah, so well, it was a good setup for me there, Tom. So yeah, I obviously qualified for US Open. I was playing qualies. I had three rounds in qualifying, and there was a hurricane coming into New York City that weekend. So I guess I qualified on the Friday, and was due to play, but didn't know who I was going to be playing in main draw. The draw, you know, hadn't, the qualifiers hadn't been put in yet, but found out on the Saturday night I was going to be playing Djokovic. And with the hurricane in New York, Brooklyn Bridge had been shut down. So there was loads of restaurants that were closed, but in our hotel there was a small list of restaurants that were open. So we went to a restaurant around the corner, pretty nice restaurant, and some other players are in there as well. But I went in and had a meal that was okay. I wouldn't say it was great. It was pretty nice, but it did something to me, and I woke up that night, was, you know, completely sick, food poisoning. Don't need to go into all the details, but you can imagine.
Yeah. And, we can imagine.
For 2 days was like having to try and, you know, rehydrate myself, but was still, it wasn't like it was just one night I was sick. I was sick for, you know, a day and a half. And yeah, it was tough because obviously it was Djokovic on Arthur Ashe. I was finally going to be playing a main draw, a stadium court. I'd played main draw Wimbledon, but on a small court. So I was going to play big time court, big time player, and was so sick. So somebody said to me it was like, you know, like having to climb Mount Everest with no clothes on. so not a nice proposition. But it made for an interesting chapter in the book, at least.
For sure. Your family were in the crowd. Everyone watched you. And what? If you want to know if the listeners want to know if you won the match or not, they have to buy the book, right?
Exactly. The clip. Spoiler alert. I didn't win. I can give it away. Don't worry. But yeah, it's an amazing experience to walk out. Like, it's so big.
Was it crowded? Were there more than 20,000 people watching this game?
No, the crowd was not full. I mean, they probably, I don't know, put a number on it, but I suppose there was a kind of a decent scattering of people that it didn't feel empty. Like, sometimes you watch Arthur Ashe afternoon session and there's a lot of empty seats. It actually was pretty full. But it's like, it's double the size of Centre Court. I mean, it's 24,000. I think Centre Court is 12,000. It's like a soccer stadium, Premier League soccer.
Yeah,
stadium,
it is.
It's absolutely huge. So, yeah, and people were calling out, like, oh, I'm from, you know, they're calling out small towns in Ireland that they were from. And
many Irish people bought tickets for your game?
Well, yeah, so many Irish in New York, you know, Irish in New York and Irish Americans and stuff. So, yeah, there was lots of people, kind of, you know, Irish people there. And yeah, it was really cool. But obviously I couldn't enjoy it the way I wanted to. But you know, it was still, as I say, it makes for, you know, it's kind of a fun story, right? And instead of maybe me going out and losing 1-1-1 against Djokovic healthy, maybe this is a funner ending to the whole thing, you know.
Jono,
that's your tip to anyone that faces Djokovic in the first round, is just make sure you get yourself a good bout of food poisoning. So you've got to
make it all about you. Yeah, exactly. Totally. Get the sympathy. Genius.
So that period, that was back to back, wasn't it? Grand Slam first rounds for you. So you'd had Wimbledon in the summer, and then obviously followed up in August with the US. And I guess from a player sense, it starts to, I imagine it's how, and I say this secondhand, I've obviously never experienced it, but how you experience tournaments when your main draw as a competitor is obviously very different to a lot of what you've experienced over the years in the various tournaments and events you've taken part. Not that you necessarily need it, but I guess it's that it whets your appetite, right? You want to be part of the, I say part of the show, but you want all the perks that come with main draw in these events.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the feeling of peace, I suppose, when you qualify. That's usually the feeling. It's just total satisfaction. And I remember, you know, the locker room in the at Arthur Ashe Stadium. You know, that's the players' locker room, and there's you know, there's areas where you get your massages. And I went in and got a massage when I finished, and then there's a place where you get your laundry done, and there's a free drink. So I'm like, got the bag slung, the laundry bag, clean clothes slung over the shoulder. I'm like getting myself free Coke in the fridge, and I'm walking out going, I'll be back here playing in the stadium, you know, in a couple of days. And yeah, I'd played in so many, you know, pretty average places. It was a lovely feeling. And yeah, it just feels like you're where you're supposed to be, and friends and family are all excited for you and happy for you. They're amazing, amazing experiences, because, you know, so much of the time outside of your immediate family, people don't even know where you're playing, you know, when you're on the Futures and Challenger Tour. You could be in any country, whereas, you know, it felt like there was people I went to school with who knew I was going to be playing. And it's just a lovely feeling. Unfortunately, only got two of those experiences, but they were still, they made a lot of the struggle sort of worthwhile.
Yeah, I've always viewed it as quite, so I know Harriet Dart, who's I think currently 75 in the world, in women, British player, third round of Wimbledon. So I'd known her since she was zero high, and her parents really well, so you know, I sort of get the occasional update from her. But it seems to me from the outside that there is almost nothing between, you know, the group that get main draw in tournaments and potentially the next, you know, next 100, 200 in the rankings. And there's always this, there's almost this weird scenario whereby things almost, if you're main draw, they get easier in terms of financially it's easier, The setup's nicer, you get looked after better. But then also you get this, once your main draw, you know, if let's say you're 50-50 in a match, well, if you're 50-50 and making main draw, that tends to be enough to stay main draw kind of thing. So it's just, yeah, it always strikes me as this weird tipping point where if you can just get the right side of it,
yeah,
you know, then to a degree there are things that get easier. Obviously, you get into the top tens area, there's an element of consistency there. But for main draw stuff, I don't know if Connor, if I'm totally misreading the reality of what it is like on the tour there. But that was always my sense.
Yeah. No, and I think when once you've done it once or twice, you start to believe a lot more, and your opponents start to believe that you're good as well, and it becomes a bit of a self perpetuating thing, and you start to feel like you belong. And I think, I don't want to speak about Harriet's career too much, because I know her journey quite well, but don't know everything about it. But like, to me, from afar, it looks like she's done a great job of kind of getting herself into that world of the top 75, top 80, because she could easily have maybe been at that 150, 160 mark, and she sort of maxed out her opportunities and really, really fought her way into the very, very top. And as you say, if you can get in there, even if you're 26, 27, getting in there for the first time, you can get 4, 5, 6 years out of that ranking and stay there. So the key is getting there for the first time, because it's nearly difficult to fall out of the top 50 once you get in there, you know, with all the points on offer.
Yeah, and by the way, I just for what it's worth, I'll say everything I've heard about, you know, Harriet from obviously her folks and stuff, but by all accounts, she just has a phenomenal work ethic. You know,
yeah, you can see it. Yeah.
There's no question of application. And I say this because obviously, you know, like so many do, she committed tennis at such an early age and was having to travel like more than any. I mean, I can barely read and write, and I'm 44, let alone, you know, sort of take yourself off to tournaments and all this, yeah, and the other. So, yeah, just huge, huge kudos to her and anyone else, of course, that, and yourself as well.
And I think there's been a group of those British girls and the wider British sort of Davis Cup and Billie Jean King Cup squads who are having that success. And the coaches are, it feels like, you know, again, I'm quite close to British tennis in terms of I saw it from afar for a long, long time. And it just, again, Raducanu, and now you're looking at Jack Draper, like they've kind of all seen what needs to happen, and it's feeding back from Tim Henman to Andy Murray to, you know, Katie Bolter. All those players are starting to get the benefits of just this information and knowledge about how to be successful that's sort of starting to become a bit more part of British tennis that wasn't there 20 years ago, and they've a lot more belief. And there's a lot more names that are successful now in British tennis than obviously was there 15, 20 years ago, which is good.
By the way, I really loved, I don't know how do you feel, to watch Dan Evans playing at the US Open this year. He's such a great fighter, right? His spirit on court, I love to, and when he plays serve and volley, I love to play him tennis.
Yeah, he's so talented. But as you say, he's got this steel and this competitiveness, and I've seen him practice up close, and I played him mm-hmm. you know, earlier in his career, but in practice which is more interesting, he's a real competitor and he really enjoys competing, even in an up to seven tiebreak of volley to volley or something, like he really wants to win that, and he's, you know, he's shouting and cheering and fist bumping the way he is at US Open. So he really, yeah, he really enjoys competing. You saw it at the Olympics with Andy Murray. That was a phenomenal job. And then,
yeah,
not only to win the match against Khachanov, but actually to go and follow it up and win that second round was so good. So, again, another guy who could easily have maybe not done what he's done. And I think he's kind of maxed out and gotten to a phenomenally high ranking. So, kudos to him.
All right. True. Let's talk about some highlights of your career, Connor. You can choose what you want to talk about. When you won against Roger Federer and the juniors, or playing on Wimbledon Center Court, or when you practiced with Richard Gasquet, and I guess he didn't say hello to you, right? in the beginning. So you can choose one of these three highlights from my point of view.
Yeah, so well, the Richard Gasquet story is pretty funny. I was playing, I was actually just out of direct acceptance to main draw of the Chennai ATP. So I think I was maybe one or two seed in qualies. I could be wrong, but I was pretty close to getting in main draw, but ended up being just out and being in qualies. And it's the first tournament of the year in January, and I just come from, so it was January 2011. It was like the coldest December in Ireland, like ever. It was proper, we don't get really proper snow in Ireland, the same as the UK. But there was like, you know, 4 or 5 feet of snow, freezing cold. And then I get to Chennai and it's like the most, there's so much humidity, so hot. Ended up getting there a few days early to practice, and maybe the day before, 2 days before my first round of qualies, I was in the referee's office and I saw the practice sheet for tomorrow, and like it was like 10 a.m. Richard Gasquet looking, you know, so he's obviously looking for a practice partner. I was like, amazing, you know, he was like 10 in the world, number one seed, crossed his name out and wrote in Conor Knight. And so I'm like, perfect, set for 10 a.m. Get there the next morning with my coach, get there a little bit early. I'm sitting down and I hear these footsteps behind me. And I look around and it's Richard walking on with his coach. And I kind of, I'm looking at him, but he doesn't look at me. And he sits down at the bench, the other side of the net, and like basically just takes out his racket and walks to the baseline with the balls. And I'm like, okay, so I guess we're not going to say hi. And I walked. I walked to the baseline and we start hitting, and we have this rally, the first rally, and it's like the rally goes on for about like 5 minutes because I'm like, I'm definitely don't want to miss. so I ended up, the rally goes on so long that Richard catches the ball because it's getting old, gives it to his coach, takes a new ball out and starts to feed it in. So I'm like, okay, at least I've proven I'm not like, you know, a really bad player.
Yeah.
And then at the end, then we play a practice set. And he beats me 6-love. I'm like, oh no. I thought I had his respect, and then he beat me 6-love. But yeah, I don't know why he didn't say hi. Maybe he was jet lagged or something. But yeah, it was an interesting incident. But yeah, maybe not a career highlight that, but it was funny.
Maybe because of his strange grip, right? I couldn't play with that grip. What about you? Weird. I mean, that's really weird, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because when you watch him put the grip on, he obviously changes it every change of ends. It actually makes like a mess of the grip. It's not even like really neat the way you'd think. He's done it so many times that the grip is perfect, but there's like gaps in the grip and the leather is through the tourniquet grip and stuff, so it doesn't even look that good. But anyway, listen, one of those things. I'll leave him off. No hard feelings.
And for the other two episodes, you didn't mention how you won against Federer again in the juniors in your book, right? Or did you?
Yeah, no, I did. Yeah, so I played. No, it's in the book. Yeah, we played.
I mentioned.
Yeah, I got that in. Yeah. found a space for that. Yeah, so played under. We were both 12, and I played a guy called Jun Kato from Switzerland in the first round, or in the first match we played against Switzerland. I lost like 6-2, 6-1, I think, pretty comfortable. But then the coaches organized a kind of a reverse match, and I played Roger. So and found these notes from my coach in my room at home, like a couple of years later, and it was like, you know, seen Ireland defeated R. Federer. So it was always sort of in my head. And then a couple of years after that, he won junior Wimbledon. And obviously, so I followed his career. But interesting. He was obviously like number two in Switzerland, a year young for under 14, and was obviously on a path. But, you know, guess didn't play a great match against me. I wasn't bad as a junior, but wasn't one of the best in Europe, that's for sure. But interesting.
I hear he thought he played a great match.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
Exactly.
But Joel, guess when Conor was playing against the wall, like every one of us, right? Like almost every listener, guess which player he was when he was competing against the wall. I was John McEnroe playing against Ivan Lendl, and John McEnroe always won, right? Connor was Boris Becker. Is that true?
Yeah.
Did you choose Boris Becker when you played against the wall?
Yeah, well, I was either Becker or Edberg. Yeah, it would both. I played because they had those, was it three finals in a row of Wimbledon? Like 80, 88, 89, 90, I think it was, or something like that.
Yeah.
So they were the two big guys. And yeah, absolutely. They were my two heroes when I was sort of 8, 7, 8, 9. And but absolutely, Boris was the main man for sure. So I used to try and copy the service motion like everybody as well. Never had a big serve, but I used to copy the motion. They were cool. Cool role models.
Again, Tom, tell me to
yeah,
to
please.
Out. But just with obviously now in your, you know, you talked about playing Federer when you were young in age group tennis, and obviously you're now in a position where you're captaining Ireland and dealing with and captaining some younger players. You'll often read articles, but invariably they're about people that have made it to the very, very top. So Federer's earliest coach just passed away, Lundgren, recently. I think he passed away a couple of days ago. So there was an article in his obituary, and I was reading it through. And of course, you always read that people say, oh, yeah, but then I saw Federer as a kid and there was just never any doubt. Do you see juniors come through and play? Because obviously we never hear, I'm sure that's said about thousands of people that never reach the whatever. Do you find that when you're sort of, when you're watching youngsters play through the island side of thing or anything else, do people really, really stand out? Or is that just said about, we only hear that it's said about the guys and girls that make it?
I've gone through a bit of an evolution on it. Like I try to not go off my eye, and I try and look at results a little bit more. I think results tell you almost all you need to know, even at the age of 14 or 15. So I think I think the very best players in the world are not coming out of nowhere, you know, at 16, 17. I think Federer at 15 won, you know, the Prato, you know, Italian big grade 2 event a couple of weeks before Roland Garros, maybe 15 going on 16. So I think generally if you haven't done something big by the time you're 15 or 16, you know, the chances are getting smaller and smaller. Now we could look at somebody who maybe like a Harriet Dart, and I don't know the ins and outs of her junior career, but maybe didn't have an absolutely massive result as a junior, but has kept going. But I think there's a difference between somebody who's sort of 75 in the world and who we're maybe talking about, which is the Grand Slam champions. Sinner, interestingly, is one who a little bit came out of nowhere in terms of no junior results, but then all of a sudden won, like, was it two challengers in a row or something at, like, when he was 17, and then just was straight away at the very top. But yeah, I mean, I remember watching Olivier Rochus, you know, at 13, and Justin Henin, and they just looked head and shoulders. And I wasn't a coach, right? I was a kid as well. And I remember looking at them going, well, they look better than everybody else I've seen. And that's sort of how it happened, that they ended up being top players. So, yeah, I think you don't need to be that sophisticated sometimes to know who's better than everybody else and who isn't. It's sometimes pretty obvious, even for kids.
I watched. I was with my brother, obviously, many, many years ago, watching at Wimbledon, and we watched some of the junior Wimbledon. This is going back some time, and there were two guys playing, and one of them just looked absolutely beautiful, you know, floating around the grass, winning comfortably, and the other guy looked really awkward, really fidgety, you know, losing his temper, and lost pretty heavily. And my brother and I said on the day, we're like, I don't, you know, like, why do people carry on, right? Like, it was such a trouncing. You think, surely you know now. And of course, the guy that lost was Leighton Hewitt.
And was that junior? Was that junior Wimbledon?
Yeah.
Why? Because he won a tour event at a ridiculously young age, didn't he? Did he win a tour event at 16 or something down in Adelaide, which is just mind blowing.
Just from the eye candy test or whatever you want to call it.
And yeah, yeah.
Obviously, kind of, if you need any help talent spotting in Ireland, I'm clearly the right guy. I'm useless.
But it's funny, you're right. Like, I mean, again, a Hewitt, you just think, oh, he's just battling around. You know, he doesn't have a big weapon, all that stuff. But yeah, I guess, yeah, the results speak for themselves.
True. But coming back to the American players, maybe, and to your career, if we talk about the great American players, some Germans as well, they did quite well at the college tennis. And you were one of the top five college players in the U.S. And you played for Berkeley in San Francisco. I think you had many, many different opportunities where you could play. But please let us know, what is it like playing college tennis? And maybe please explain also the atmosphere and what is it like to play against a cheater, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a scene in the book where, because in college tennis, you call your own lines. Now, there's sort of, yeah. there's an umpire on court who can get involved if there's something really, really obvious. And most players are decent in terms of line calling, but my expectations there are pretty low. Like, there's usually at least, you know, one or two calls a match that, you know, if a ball is, if there's any doubt, it's being called out, you know. And, you know, if there's a crowd there and the ball, I hit this one passing shot on a player and, you know, it's called covering. So he kind of covered the ball, kind of showed his back to the crowd because the crowd were only on one side. And I knew as I hit the passing shot, I'm like, oh, he's going to cover this and call it wide no matter where it bounces, because, you know, there's so much riding on it. And yeah, there should be umpires and lines judges really on court when you think about the stakes. Like, if you think about the college football, you know, events, like, could you imagine expecting the kind of kids to be calling their own their own fouls in the football? It's not really realistic. So yeah, there's bad line calling, there's lots of drama, but I loved it. It was 4 years. It was a nice stepping stone for me because I didn't know at 17, 18 quite where I was sitting in the world of tennis and whether I was going to be a legitimate Varo.
Is that an option or is it the perfect preparation becoming a pro player?
I think it's an option. I think mm-hmm. you ain't seen Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner going to college. You know, I think if you want to be the best you can be, I think being out on the tour, there's no substitute for just living and breathing tennis. But I think it's not for everybody. Not everybody's ready to be a pro, you know, and have a job at 17 or 18. So I think it's an option, but I think it's probably a sign that maybe you've a little bit of a limit on what you can do. And I think thinking about Kevin Anderson and John Isner, like, they were both like 6'10" and 6'8". So I guess they were probably going to be hitting their aces and winning on tour whether they went to college or not, right? So they were a little bit of a different type of example. But Cameron Norrie's been interesting. You know, he's done so well out of college.
Great. But before we will end with a tennis graduation, Connor, I have some really great tennis, and the category you have chosen together with your joker Jonathan is Irish Tennis Davis Cup. So we will come to that later. I already mentioned, we already talked about him. Maybe the biggest victory beside Roger Federer, etc., it was the match against this young gentleman who sent me a voice message.
Hey Connor, Jim May here. Tom has kindly shared a screenshot of a match we played 2006. You beat me two in love. Absolute cuffing. Oh my god. Hope all well, and look forward to reading your book. Take it easy.
So, I mean, we have to talk about Jim May. He is my idol. He's the legend.
He's a legend. And what a beautiful game as well. Servant volleyer. He always did it the right way. A purist.
What is it like to bagel God?
I completely forgotten. I should have... Again, it's another one I should have put in the book, actually. I can't believe I missed the opportunity to have that in paper forever. Maybe he's scared. Maybe he hasn't read the book yet because he's worried, you know, he's going to see that result in there. But no, I don't remember that. 2006, I just finished in college, so I had a lot of matches under my belt and was getting ready to go on the tour. But me and Jim are the same year, 81, and he was a huge U2 fan, probably still is a big U2 fan. So when I was, you know, the Irish guy in the draw, he'd be coming over to you, chatting to me about U2 and stuff. But a great guy. And I see him, he's a member of Wimbledon. So I see him, you know, we sometimes play matches against Wimbledon for my club in Dublin. So I see him and get to catch up for a beer with him every now and then, which is always good fun.
Jim has this, Jim's one of these guys, I say a bit old school, sort of not like huge ripping topspin or anything like that, but he has the skill in mixed doubles to ace people very politely. you know, mixed doubles, there's
an etiquette, yeah.
Yeah, there's a balance to be had when you're playing a mixed, and he's just got the ability to ace people without it being unacceptable. Yeah. It's a great skill.
Well, it's probably such a smooth sort of, you know, it's not going past in an aggressive manner, but it has gone past them, you know, without them touching it. But yeah, no, that sort of sounds right. Yeah, you couldn't really stay angry at him for too long. So yeah, he has that all right.
we had a sort of an NCL, like a club league match a while ago, and I went down to watch it, and he was up playing number one for us, and we're playing up at the club we were playing against was sort of a local rival, and the guy playing at one had a bit of a reputation as coming back to this cheating thing of kind of, you know, maybe when push comes to shove, seeing the ball slightly differently. But just as they were knocking up, and obviously there are a handful of people watching, Jim just in his very polite way says, let's call the guy Dave, for want of a better phrase. He's like, oh, hey Dave, not going to have any problems with those line calls today, are we? But you know, just like, it sounded fun. Everyone had a giggle, but at the same time, clearly just like setting a mark from the beginning, so that you didn't have to deal with it.
I think the word is tact. Make a point without making an enemy. That's Jim. Yeah,
there we go.
Yeah, thanks to Jim from my side for the voice message. One question concerning sponsor badges. I think you called it patches in your book as well, because I'm not sure if I got it right. You get £6,000 for one tournament, is that correct, if you get a sponsor badge for, let's say, playing Wimbledon first round, or what is it, what's the deal?
Yeah, well, that's what I got for playing Djokovic. Yeah, so obviously I got to play on a show court. It was going to be televised. Yeah. It was going to be against Djokovic. So as soon as the draw came out, I got contacted by, you know, a couple of agents and companies and said, listen, will you wear the little, you know, the little badge on the sleeve? You know, and you see it when, is it Mary Corr or COHR? You see those little sleeves that players wear on stadium courts. So they just, and like, they literally hand you a bag of this stuff and are like, you know, they hand you a bag of these patches and are like, yeah. So that's the
get
contract,
it on.
Basically. Get it. Find a way. They didn't hand me a thread and a needle, a needle and thread even. And it shows you how little sewing I've done. I called it a thread and a needle, not a needle and thread. And yeah, they, you know, they pay you to put it on. And yeah, it's a sort of a strange one. And as soon as the match is over, you know, you take the patch off and go again. But when I was going on court, they, you know, the one of the supervisors said that the patch was too big, or I can't even remember why the patch was okay on one shirt and wasn't on another. So I ended up having to wear a shirt that I didn't want to wear. I wanted to wear a green shirt because I'm Irish, obviously, on Arthur Ashe, and I'm having to change to like the white shirt, which didn't look as good and obviously wasn't green, and that was kind of annoying, as well as the food poisoning. But yeah, so yeah, it's all. But again, I made more money off, you know, wearing a patch for 45 minutes than I did winning, you know, some challengers. So yeah, it's kind of strange.
I think I'd probably get a tattoo on my forehead for £6,000.
back in 2011 as well, like the world economy was on its knees. It was good money. But yeah, so I'm sure the money's gone up since. God knows, the guys are probably getting £20,000 these days. Who knows?
Jono, I'm asking for a friend. If Life Jacket wants to do some advertisement, right?
Yeah.
the thing about Jack is, isn't it, don't Nike have a thing where they don't allow their players to wear any patches to sort of
maybe
dilute the Nike brand? So if you look at any, where it's Rory McIlroy or whoever, if they're wearing Nike, they don't wear any patches.
Very good.
So you can't get a Life Jacket patch on Jack tonight, unfortunately, Jono.
Oh man.
Yeah, and also, yeah, I'm not sure on his thread and needle abilities
either. Yeah. Nice. No, guys, he'd farm that out.
I wouldn't say we're running out of time, but there would be 100 more questions, but let's finish with the graduation, because Connor, as you, well, you can't know, because I've just recorded, I would say, between 50 and 60 episodes with many former professional German players, Patrick mm-hmm. Kühn, Markus Söcker, etc., Ricky Osterthun, Tore Meinecke, blah, 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 blah. Well, of course they are in German, and that's why I would call it the first English graduation. And, wait, please don't take it too serious. But as an Irish Davis Cup team captain, you might know the history of Davis Cup from Ireland perfectly. Is that true?
I have as good an idea as anyone, I would say, but I wouldn't say I have a perfect memory of it.
That's why you have the Joker, Jonathan Sumner, with you, who's an expert in that category.
Okay.
So, in which year was Ireland attending the first time a Davis Cup?
Oh, 1923.
And what? Which player? It's correct, man!
I swear to God, I didn't know that.
Are you serious?
I swear I didn't. Well, I didn't know, man, I knew it, if you know what I mean. It's obviously somewhere in my brain, but I swear.
That's understatement. That's the team captain. That's the spirit against Tunisia next week. Who has Brilliant. The most total wins? Which Irish player?
Owen Casey, I think.
Correct. How many years did Michael, I hope I pronounce his name correct, Hickey?
Yeah.
Michael Hickey played?
Oh, God.
How many years?
If I get this right, 24?
Less. Jono, what do you think?
Go on, John.
I think Connor needs a joker.
It's a good few. 16 or something.
I help you. 24 minus 8. Yeah, wait, Jono can't count. That's the problem.
No, it's just Connor just said it.
16. All right. As I told both of you while I was preparing this podcast,
24 years would be absolutely ridiculous in hindsight, but still. Knowing Michael Hickey, I'm not surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. But anyway.
Yeah. While I was preparing this podcast, I watched a great YouTube video from 1983. The USA played Davis Cup in Ireland. Who was playing for the American team against Ireland? I think, was it in Dublin?
Yeah, it was in Dublin, yeah.
So, and I put the YouTube video in the show notes of this podcast, so everyone can watch it. It's really, really great video. And a big
John
name
McEnroe,
from the US.
John McEnroe.
Yes.
John McEnroe, for sure. And I think the other guy was Elliot Telcher.
Oh, yes. But who was playing doubles together with McEnroe?
Okay. Peter Fleming?
Correct, man. Okay. You're perfect. And now you get the $1 million question.
Yeah. Who was the fourth?
I don't know. I'm sorry. Yeah. But these three, they played for sure. And who was playing for Ireland?
Matt Doyle and Sean Sorensen, for
Correct.
Sure. And was Michael Hickey maybe the third guy?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Probably.
Not speak on it. That would have been my answer.
Yeah.
In the YouTube video, you can see the first singles, John McEnroe, against Matt Doyle.
Yeah,
which
and then
record
lost
brand?
Telcher lost to Sean to Matt, right, or Sean? I think in that match. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, maybe. The $1 million question is: which record brand was used by Matt Doyle?
Wow,
Jono?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm going to guess Dunlop, but I don't know.
I'm going to go with I don't. I'm going to go with Donne.
Both wrong. Michael Chung played this record as well.
Not a Schnarrish or something?
Prince?
No. Oh, Prince. Sorry,
Prince.
Of course. Yeah, yeah.
What?
Schnarrish. Prince. Yeah, what? Yeah.
Okay, but I would say you graduated. Congratulations. the first man outside Germany who graduated at Doublette 76 tennis. We call it tennis Abitur in Germany. I would say we've talked 1 hour. Seriously, thank you very much. Congratulations to your book, to your great career as well. You were number 127 in the world. Is that correct?
129, but...
129, yeah, sorry. 129, 129. From my point of view, in this podcast, we celebrate tennis. We are big tennis fans, enthusiasts. And I have great respect. I know that the topic of your book is slightly different, but 110% respect for your career and being a Davis Cup coach, being a Davis Cup player, winning for your country. Because, you know, Jono and I, we didn't do it, right? And even if you're number 200, 800, or 1,600 in the world, I think it's great, right? Because we love tennis, and tennis is not only being top 10 player.
Yeah, I think the best, the reason that players at the very top of the game are so amazing is because, you know, there's quality there at 100 and 300. You know, the guys 350 in the world are so talented, you know, and have dedicated their lives to the sport. And there's such a small, we talked about earlier, such a small difference, really, between the guys, say, 300-400 and the guys 80, 70, 80. And, you know, so it's a very deep sport. So, yeah, thank you. But thank you for your kind words, and I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
And thank you to my co-host, straight arm drinking global champion Jonathan Sumner.
I would say my introduction was straight arm drinking, and then Connor's involved Federer, Djokovic, US Open. And by the way, and that is perfectly reflective of what we have respectively achieved in our lives. So,
and all I was interested in was, well, tell me more about the straight arm drinking at the top of the show. I was like, tell me more. This is so exciting.
We're going to write a book about it. That's
legal.
But no, Jono, just from yeah. Tom, thank you so much for getting involved. And
my pleasure.
As well. It's to Tom's point, it's just really nice. You know, we love tennis. It's nice chatting about it and getting a bit of an inside line on stuff. But Tom is absolutely right. Just huge, huge kudos to anyone, be it tennis or anything else, that commits themselves to something. It's hard yards to do a lot of these things. They're so competitive. But thank you very much.
And my last words, buy the book. I put all the links into the show notes. Or listen to the book, Connor. My respect. You read it by yourself. What was more tough, practicing at Nick Bollettieri or reading your book on tape for 6-7 hours?
Oh my goodness! It was hotter in the studio than it was on the court in Florida, actually. So I'm not sure, but no, it was a cool experience reading it. Yeah, it was 3 days in a studio, but writing it was a hell of a lot harder than reading it, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, great. Because we had so many guests who were guests or practicing at Nick Bollettieri, but that's a topic for another episode, I think. Again, thank you very much, both of you. Take care and good luck playing against Tunisia.
Guys, really enjoyed it. Chat soon. Bye-bye. Cheers.
Please follow Dublette76 on Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn.
You cannot be serious! You cannot be serious! You cannot be serious!
Folgt Dublette76 bei Instagram oder LinkedIn. Dublette76 wird präsentiert von Brainseeker Consulting.